What do you think when you hear the word Anabaptist? Now, if you were here last week, you might think some new things. But previously, the word Anabaptist, what comes to mind? Maybe it's the Amish, right? Those driving on their horse and buggies down the side of the road, maybe in southwestern Ontario or Pennsylvania. Perhaps you think of Hutterites, for those of you who might be from out west. Maybe you knew that in 2009, Hutterites took the province of Alberta to the Supreme Court because they didn't want their picture taken from a religious perspective. They thought that was against their faith. They ultimately lost. So according to the court, they do need to get their pictures taken. Maybe you think of Old Order Mennonites. There are some Old Order Mennonites in this area, and they might be a little bit more technologically connected to modern-day society, but they still choose to stand out with what they wear. Perhaps these are the things that you picture when you think of Anabaptists. But there's one other picture that I want to put in your minds today, and that's just for you to look around the room here today, or the room wherever you are. Because we, too, have Anabaptist heritage. We, too, are Anabaptists. Now, you might know that we're actually a part of a denomination called the Be in Christ Church of Canada, the BIC. And I talked about this last week, where the BIC has a major portion of what we believe from the Anabaptists. It's not just from the Anabaptists. There are other traditions in there as well. But this morning, and in this series, we are talking about Anabaptism, because this month, again, as a reminder, we're celebrating the 500th year anniversary of the birth of Anabaptists and the Anabaptist movement. It was ultimately a renewal movement. It wasn't just about ideas, but about a radical return to Jesus-centered, Spirit-led, and community-shaped living. Community-shaped living. And that's what we want to talk about today. We want to learn from our Anabaptist heritage and remember the importance of community in our lives and what that means and what that looks like and how we become shaped by that. Before I go any further, though, I want to read a quote to you from Henry Nouwen. Some of you might know Henry Nouwen, and he says this about community. Community is the place where the person you least want to live with always lives. Often we surround ourselves with the people we most want to live with, thus forming a club or a clique, but not a community. Anyone can form a club. It takes grace, shared vision, and hard work to form a community. And that's the unique thing about community. Community isn't just where we belong. It's not just where we put our name or we sign up for. It's where we become. It's where we are shaped and refined and ultimately sent out by each other. This was true in the early church as well. You see, they didn't just preach about Jesus, but they became a community that embodied him. They became an interconnected community. They lived lives that impacted each other. And we see this all throughout the New Testament. We see it over and over and over again. In fact, there is this phrase, this term, one another. We see it almost 100 times in the New Testament, in many different contexts and saying many different things. We are to love one another, bear with one another, honor one another, serve one another, be devoted to one another, forgive one another, live in harmony with one another, agree with one another, be humble towards one another, have fellowship with one another. And no, I'm not going to read all 100, but there are 10 to think about. In all different aspects of our lives, we are to be interconnected with one another. And perhaps we see this idea of being interconnected the most clearly in the book of Acts. Now, in the book of Acts, chapter 2, and you might recognize these verses, but a little bit of context for you. In verse 42, it says, the believers devoted themselves to the apostles' teacher. But who were the believers? What is happening here in this passage? Well, I can tell you, Pentecost, something called Pentecost, just happened. This is where we hear about these tongues of fire resting on people's heads and all the different languages that are being heard, people's own languages heard by people who don't normally speak them. This is an incredible event. The gospel is proclaimed, and it says over 3,000 people were baptized into new life. They joined the community. You see, this movement, this Jesus movement, in this passage that we read, it goes from this event, right? This amazing, incredible event that changes so many lives that people probably remember forever. In fact, that we still talk about today. It goes from this amazing event to everyday life. To everyday life. And maybe you've experienced that before. Maybe you've been on a high on the mountaintop. Right, you've had an experience. Maybe it was at a retreat or a missions trip. Maybe you had an amazing conversation with someone that impacted you, and you remember those words, every single word that was spoken. Maybe after those incredible life-changing events, you try to go back to your everyday life, and it's hard. You come down off that mountain, and you're in a valley. And to live that changed life that you were so certain you would be able to live on that weekend retreat or as a result of that conversation becomes a little bit more difficult. And maybe it feels like it's not possible. Well, I love this passage because this passage depicts this amazing event, this incredible time, this life-changing thing that happens to thousands of people. And it shows us then what that looks like in everyday life. You see, because what we're talking about isn't just revival, right? It's not just where we baptize 3,000 people, but it's a relational revolution. It's a relational revolution. Okay, so will you read with me now in Acts 2? This is starting at verse 42. The believers devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, to the community, and to their shared meals and to their prayers. A sense of awe came over everyone. God performed many wonders and signs through the apostles. All the believers were united and shared everything. They would sell pieces of property and possessions and distribute the proceeds to everyone who needed them. Every day they met together in the temple and ate in their homes. They shared food with gladness and simplicity. They praised God and demonstrated God's goodness to everyone. And the Lord added daily to the community those who were being saved. The Lord added daily to the community those who were being saved. You know, we see a similar passage in Acts 4, just a couple chapters later. Except there it includes a line, now the whole group of those who believed were of one heart and soul. They were of one heart and soul. They were together. They were interconnected. And so we see through this passage that we just read that these disciples, they were devoted to community, right? They had mutual participation. It wasn't just casual attendance. They didn't just show up, but their lives were changed as a result of being part of this community. The idea of sharing was a normal aspect of their lives. Needs were seen and needs were met. They had daily togetherness around worship and meals. There was fruit as a result of this, right? The Lord added daily to their numbers. These are the incredible things that happen when we move from an event to real life, to daily life. And like the early church here, early Anabaptists believed that true faith must be lived in visible and communal ways. The church is not just a place we go, it's a people that we become. It's not just a place we go, it's a people that we become. Let's explore that a little bit more, will we? So in community, we are shaped by shared identity. In community, we are shaped by a shared identity. We see this in Acts 2, verse 42. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the community. We see another example of this in Luke 5. In Luke 5, verses 1 to 11, this is where we see Jesus calling the first disciples. Here Jesus sees some fishermen on the beach, and he gets in one of their boats, and he tells them to push off. He wants to preach to the crowd that has gathered. And so they do that. They listen to them, to him. And it's an incredible time. People's lives are changed as a result of that. After Jesus preaches, he tells the fishermen to push off a bit more, to go into the deeper water, and to cast their nets out. Well, these fishermen are overwhelmed by the amount of fish that they catch. They bow to Jesus, and Jesus responds in verse 10 by saying, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will be fishing for people." And as soon as they brought their boats to the shore, they left everything and followed Jesus. They left everything and followed Jesus. You see, this is not just a call to believe something new. It's a call to belong to something bigger. To leave everything and follow Jesus. Peter, the fisherman here, has a personal encounter with Jesus. It's true. He changes his life. There's an event in Peter's life that impacts him forever. But the result of that event in Peter's life is a shared calling. James and John are already there. They don't go off individually. They leave everything together. And they follow Jesus as a new kind of community. In the Gospels, Jesus shapes his disciples into a new identity, apprentices of the kingdom. Peter meets Jesus in a boat, but he becomes a disciple in community. And that is so true for us today as well. And it was true for the early Anabaptists. It's true. They echoed this exact same pattern. Faith was not just internal. It was public, shared, and accountable. Following Jesus means joining a people, not just believing an idea. It means adopting beliefs, values, and practices that are bigger than just us. That is what it means to be a part of a community, and that is what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. By community, we are refined through relationships. We are refined through relationships. I would suggest that transformation is a group project, and I love group projects. I'll let you hypothesize why that is the case, but I really do. And so I want to ask you a question today. Who has permission to tell you the truth about yourself? Who in your life has permission to tell you the truth about yourself? The good, the bad, or the ugly? Is there anyone? Is there anyone that you allow to speak into you in a way that you trust them and in a way that you will let them change you? Because that is an important part of being in community. In Matthew 18, we see Jesus teaching his disciples, and he says, "If your brother or sister sins against you, go and correct them when you are alone together. If they listen to you, then you've won over your brother or your sister. But if they won't listen, take with you one or two others. And if they still won't pay attention, report it to the church." You see, here Jesus assumes that his followers will mess up. And I love this assumption. I love this assumption. Because it's true. It's true. And I think if we realize that and understand that about each of us in community, then we see here a gracious path towards communal healing. You see, the goal in this passage in Matthew 18, when he talks about go and correct them or bring others, the goal isn't to expose shame or guilt. It's not to put someone down, but it's about restoration. It's a path towards healing. It's an opportunity to be within the fullness of community. Right, there is a rhythm here. There's private conversation, a few trusted witnesses, the gathered church. It's about tenderness and working together. It's about community living. We are refined through each other. In this model, we see Jesus demonstrating that community is the catalyst for discipleship. It's the catalyst for change within us through each other. You see, early Anabaptists believed that community wasn't authentic unless it included discipleship, confession, and restoration. They believed that community wasn't real, it wasn't true community unless there was failure and forgiveness, unless there was authenticity and restoration. And that's the beauty of it, because sometimes when we gather with people, we feel like we need to put our best foot forward. We need to be the best version of ourselves and have no issues. We are afraid of our failures or afraid of our failures going before us. And sometimes when we feel so strongly about that, that can prevent us from being a part of community. It can prevent us from joining in or investing in these groups. But the beauty is in community, in shared compassion and forgiveness, we have the ability to be restored, right? We don't have to feel the guilt or the shame of these things that we struggle with, these masks that we put on, but we can know the true healing restoration of Jesus through each other, right? Sometimes we avoid confrontation. We ghost people. We disappear instead of honestly loving each other. And so I ask again, who has permission to tell you the truth about yourself? Is it the people around you? Your loved ones? Maybe a spouse? Maybe a best friend? Is it your life group? These aren't the people that you need to be hiding from. These are not obstacles to our discipleship. No, the opposite is true. They are instruments that God uses. Believe it or not, and this might be a surprise, we don't actually always grow as disciples through sermons and singing. And it's true. It is a part of it. It is important. This matters. But we're refined through each other, through the rubbing and coming together, through the interaction, those tension points. That is where we experience the restoration, the love, and the forgiveness of Jesus through each other. Our goal shouldn't be and isn't a smooth ride with no bumps along the way. We should expect bumps, and that means that we have the opportunity to experience Jesus together. And number three, for community. For community. We are sent to serve the vulnerable. We are sent to serve the vulnerable. In Luke 4, in Luke 4, 16 to 21, let me read this for you here. Jesus went to Nazareth, where he had been raised. On the Sabbath, he went to the synagogue as he normally did and stood up to read. The synagogue assistant gave him the scroll from the prophet Isaiah. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the prisoners, and recovery of sight to the blind, to liberate the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." He rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the synagogue assistant, and sat down. Every eye in the synagogue was fixed on him. He began to explain to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled just as you heard it." What a picture. What an image. People are shocked and they stare at him. And Jesus says, "Yes, it is as you have heard." This is Jesus' first recorded public sermon. He's quoting Isaiah 61 here. And here he announces his mission as one rooted in justice, healing, and restoration. You see, his mission is directed towards the poor, the imprisoned, the blind, and the oppressed. Ultimately, towards the vulnerable. You see, this wasn't just a spiritual statement. It was a social, economic, and deeply practical. We read on that it made people angry. And I'm not surprised by that. Because if I'm honest, this passage makes me a little bit uncomfortable too. It's much simpler to sit back and listen and feel like we've done our part. But you see, in Acts 2, that passage that we read earlier, that early church, that image there, it becomes the living embodiment of Luke 4. They had this incredible life-changing event, and then when it came to everyday life, they met real needs through sacrificial giving. They practiced economic justice, not just charity. They gave above and beyond. They saw each other's needs. They saw each other's needs. And they demonstrated God's goodness. And as a result, God added to their number daily. You know, the Anabaptists, hundreds of years ago and all through these past 500 years, have been known for caring for the sick during plagues, for providing for the poor, for refusing violence, even when it cost them everything. And so often, it cost them everything. They didn't wait for the state, the country, or the church hierarchy. They believed that every local church was a community of action, sent into the world to reflect Jesus, us, that we have been sent into the world, that this community is here in this place, that this community is planted here to make a difference in this geographical location. It was sent, we have been sent to the world to reflect Jesus. In some ways, we could say that our discipleship is incomplete if we don't bend towards the vulnerable, if we don't lean in towards those in need. You might say, "Wow, Mark, that's harsh. That's extreme." It could be. It could be. But this is what we're called to in community. And the beauty of it is that we as individuals can't do this alone. It's not about each one of us as individuals coming alone and changing the world and making a difference, but coming together and doing it in community. You see, we live in a time when the church is often known for the things that we're against, for the positions that we believe, than for its compassion. And in Luke 4, we're reminded that our witness is tied to our compassion for others. And so I would encourage you, just as the early disciples did, to look around you, to see the need in your community, on your street, as you walk out the doors in the place that you are, and to look for those who are hurting and who are in need. To ask Jesus to give you eyes to see those the way he sees them. And to ask ourselves, are we willing to be inconvenienced, to give generously, to love sacrificially? Are we willing to do that? To invite those who are on the outside in. In community, we are shaped by shared identity. By community, we are refined through relationships. And for community, we are sent to serve the vulnerable. You know, this passage reminds me, and when I think about the early Anabaptists and the sacrifices, right? We talked about this idea of all of us being needed for this. The entire sacrifice of ourselves reminds me of a story, and perhaps you remember it. In 2006 in Pennsylvania, there was a one-room schoolhouse in an Amish community. It was in a farmland. It was a normal day, October 2nd. And that morning, someone showed up who was hostile to that group. He actually worked with them. He was a local truck driver. His name was Charles Carl Roberts. And he entered that school, and he took hostages. He freed some, and he kept others. And ultimately, he shot 10 kids. After that, he took his own life. As a result, 6 children died, and 4 survived with lifelong injuries. Physical and emotional scars that they have held on to since that moment. Obviously, this is a tragic story, just terrible. So when the shooter's family wanted to have a funeral for him, for Charles, obviously they wanted a small, private funeral. They didn't want to let people know. They didn't want to publicize it. In fact, they didn't want anyone there. And about a week later, when they had this funeral, 40 Amish people showed up. They showed up not to judge or condemn, but they showed up to love and support and offer forgiveness. You see, their Amish neighbors visited and comforted the shooter's widow and family. They not only attended his funeral, but they established a fund for his family. Forgiveness was the default. The old schoolhouse where the shooting happened was torn down. A new one called New Hope was built. And the story became a global symbol for forgiveness. Of course, how could it not? It became a global symbol for faith and for the struggle to overcome tragedy with grace. And I think we can hear this story and we can think the incredible power of forgiveness and grace. That is the core of this message. Something so tragic. There is maybe nothing worse than what happened on that day. And so what that community did, what those Amish people did and how they surrounded that family and showed compassion and love is obviously at the center of this story. But there's one other thing that I want to mention. And I want to read this part to you. When Donald Crabill, professor at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College, was asked in an interview about the dramatic response by the Amish, compared especially to other Christians in America at the time, he said, "Well, I would say the difference here with the Amish is that this is a part of their cultural DNA. They aren't individualistic like other Americans are. So the burden doesn't fall so much on the individual to forgive. Although individuals obviously are a part of the process, but this is more built into the cultural rhythms and the cultural DNA of the Amish community." You see, it's the community that allows them to forgive. As individuals, it's hard, almost impossible. But as a community, when you come together, you can do incredible things. That we as a community can change the world as a result of the forgiveness that we offer. As a result of being shaped, of being refined, of being sent out. You see, community isn't just where we belong. It's where we become. It's where we are formed together. And that is my encouragement for us today, that we would be formed together, that we would allow ourselves to be shaped and refined and sent out together. Will you pray with me? Jesus, we are so grateful for your example in our life, for your teachings, and for your emphasis on this idea of community. That you knew we needed each other is life-changing. And I pray, Jesus, that today we could understand that in new and fresh ways, that our lives could be changed as a result of your love in this community that you have brought us to. In your name we pray. Amen.